I'd like to introduce Mr. Paparian, who is the former mayor of Pasadena before I moved here, unfortunately, because I've heard very good things about him and his term of office. And he is representing a young man from the Pomona area whom most of you probably have read about. Any rate, without further ado, Bill Paparian. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris, and thanks to the Pasadena Foothill chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union for this opportunity to share with you some insights and some important information about a case that I think deserves to be on your agenda, a case that the ACLU should take up and follow and needs to be more informed about. As civil libertarians, I know that all of you are aware of what has occurred under the Ashcroft Justice Department, the rollback of the guidelines that were put in place by the Church Committee in the late 70s to restrain what the FBI had been doing during the infamous COINTELPRO era of investigating people who were exercising their First Amendment rights. And we have become aware of incidents that have occurred throughout the United States. For example, in Colorado, the Colorado Coalition Against the War in Iraq, where two undercover police officers actually infiltrated a local peace group posing as boyfriend and girlfriend, attended training sessions for activists who were preparing for a sit-in action at the local Air National Guard base. One of them even got arrested as part of that action. Here in California, in Fresno, an organization known as Peace Fresno, that's the local anti-war group in the Fresno area, was infiltrated by an undercover sheriff's deputy from the Sheriff's Department Anti-Terrorism Unit. And I'm sure that you've seen the New York Times coverage in November of last year that revealed what many of us had suspected, that the Federal Bureau of Investigation was collecting extensive information on the tactics, training, and organization of anti-war demonstrators, and had advised local law enforcement officials to report any suspicious activity at protests to its counter-terrorism squads. As we saw the anti-war movement begin to blossom and grow here in Southern California, we witnessed that there were local actions that were occurring, peace vigils that were occurring throughout Southern California. But those peace activists really had a lot to learn from one dedicated group in Orange County, especially in Brea, the hometown of Joshua Thomas Canole. And these brave anti-war activists began to organize and assemble at an intersection just miles from the birthplace of Richard Nixon. Now, this attracted a great deal of attention, first in the local press, the Orange County Register, but then later, a television and radio commentator named Sean Hannity. Now, I don't regularly watch Fox television, but I began to monitor it as I got involved in Josh's case. And I learned some interesting things about Fox television, the network, Sean Hannity, their connections to the Bush administration, the way they, in many ways, act as cheerleaders and spokespersons for the Bush administration and the Ashcroft Justice Department agenda. Mr. Hannity was upset about the anti-war protests that were occurring in Brea and called for counter-demonstrators. And in February of last year, this attracted a lot of media attention. Now, why am I mentioning all of this to you? I want to share with you a photograph. This was taken at an anti-war gathering in Brea. I'm going to hold it up, and I'll pass it around in just a moment. But this is Joshua Thomas Canole holding a sign that says, "Bush is a fascist Nazi corporate pig." Now, I'm assured by Josh that He did not really misspell the word fascist, but that's how they spell it in Texas. My favorite sign is the one next to it that says, France was right. Now, I want you to remember this photograph, and I'm going to leave it up there as I begin to make my presentation this evening, because this photograph is going to become more important later on. But if any anti-war group in Southern California had attracted the attention of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, of the anti-terrorism squads of the local police department, it was this group and this young man, Joshua Thomas Canole. As you can see from the photograph, and you'll meet him a little bit later this evening, he's very tall and he's very lean. That, in fact, also will be important later on. Josh Canole lives in an environmental co-op in Pomona. There's a group of young people there. They're peace activists. They're environmental activists. They're the kind of young people we used to say in the 60s that politics was the way you live your life, and they certainly live it. They're off the electronic grid. They're totally solar independent. The people there are involved in a number of different issues, food, not bombs. One of them has gone to Palestine on two occasions to help the Palestinian people against the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Others are active in the anti-war movement. They're all people highly educated. They all work. They all have jobs. But that's the place that Josh Canole lives. Josh, in addition to being an anti-war activist, is also an environmentalist. And it's the environmental movement that we need to talk about briefly to understand the context in which the case of Josh Canole emerges. What we know as environmentalism really began in the 1900s when wilderness prophet John Muir and others established the Sierra Club in San Francisco. The Sierra Club and other large, powerful, mainstream environmental organizations have always used the legal system to force compliance with environmental laws, and they've been willing to compromise on issues in their environmental advocacy. The approach of groups like the Sierra Club has resulted in impressive achievements, a system of national parks, the Wilderness Act of 1964, which protects development from some of our most important ecological treasures. The Clean Air and Clean Water Act are examples. I remember the birth of the environmental movement. I remember I was a junior in college. The first Earth Day occurred in 1970. Protection of the environment had become a popular cause. But within a dozen years, a new breed of environmentalist had emerged, prepared to engage in direct action in the politics of confrontation. The first eco-warriors emerged from the ranks of the expatriate American community who had fled north to Canada to escape military service during the Vietnam War. They formed a committee with the ironically peaceful name, the Don't Make Waves Committee, to stop U.S. nuclear weapons testing in the Aleutian Islands. The committee rented a boat and renamed it Greenpeace. Their mission was to sail so close to the testing site as to force its cancellation in order to prevent an environmental catastrophe caused by nuclear testing. And they succeeded. They halted nuclear testing in the Aleutian Islands. Thus, Greenpeace was born. And this group went on to protest and stop nuclear testing by the French government near Tahiti. And it's evolved into one of the most ambitious worldwide environmental organizations. And I should note that the Bush administration has recently launched a criminal prosecution of Greenpeace because of a nonviolent direct action protest targeting the illegal importation of endangered mahogany from the Amazon. And John Ashcroft has charged them under a bizarre 1872 law to protect against what's known as quote-unquote sailor mongering. But Greenpeace was not alone in using direct action in those early days. Some used environmental sabotage as early as the 1970s. The most famous, my personal favorite, he was never apprehended, he or she, I should say, was known as the Fox. And this person diverted toxic waste from a U.S. steel plant to a location inside the chief executive's office. In the 1980s, a new group emerged out of the Southwest desert, determined to protect the Colorado River in Arizona. They called themselves Earth First, and they quickly gained a reputation for bold, hardcore activism. They moved on into Oregon, where in April of 1983, four people blockaded a bulldozer. These tactics of civil disobedience were replaced by acts of sabotage in defense of the environment, or ecotage. A favorite tactic was monkey wrenching, the disabling of a truck or bulldozer, and tree spiking, the driving of nails into trees to prevent them from being cut down. By April of 1990, 20 years after the first Earth Day, these eco-warriors were being branded as eco-terrorists by the Conservative Heritage Foundation, which noted the emergence of a radical environmental guerrilla movement. Arson attacks had begun, and Earth Day of 1990 saw the sabotage of electrical transmission towers in central California, causing the cutting off of power to the nearby city of Santa Cruz. Most environmentalists continued to work within the system, but for others, the time for civilized behavior had passed. The time had come, eco-warriors say, for an underground army to rise up to save the Earth from destruction. One such group is the Earth Liberation Front, which has often worked together with another group known as the Animal Liberation Front, which is committed to end the abuse and exploitation of animals. The Federal Bureau of Investigation estimates that these two groups have committed more than 600 criminal acts in the United States, resulting in damages in excess of $100 million. The Earth Liberation Front has claimed responsibility for many arson attacks throughout the country, from Vail, Colorado to Medford, Oregon. The FBI, the United States Justice Department, has responded. They view all of this as another form of a terrorism threat confronting the United States, and they divide terrorism between international terrorism and domestic terrorism. There are now nearly 1,700 FBI special agents assigned to investigate both international and domestic terrorism. They work with local law enforcement agencies through what are called joint terrorism task forces. These task forces have been established in 56 cities throughout the United States. There are now approximately 30 pending investigations of incidents of domestic terrorism. Here in California, the California Attorney General's Office, after 9/11, established the California Anti-Terrorism Information Center to monitor terrorist threats and issue warnings and advisories to local law enforcement agencies. The center is funded annually at a cost of $6.7 million. It also keeps files on anti-war organizations and groups such as the Earth Liberation Front. On April 1st of last year, the California Anti-Terrorism Information Center issued an advisory entitled American Terrorists Declare War. This advisory was a warning to all law enforcement agencies in California that the Earth Liberation Front had just declared war on the establishment as part of the anti-war movement against the Bush administration invasion of Iraq. The advisory linked this domestic terrorist group with everybody who opposed the war, in specifically stating, and I'm quoting from the advisory, quote, "Protesters at past demonstrations with causes similar to those expressed by the Earth Liberation Front, Animal Liberation Front, and anti-war adherents have committed violent crimes to further their beliefs. Nationally, these crimes have included arson, vandalism, and assaults on police officers." Law enforcement authorities encountering anti-war protesters should be aware there may be environmental or animal rights members and anarchists willing to commit acts of violence regarding the anti-war movement. End of quote. There was another advisory from the California Anti-Terrorism Information Center that was issued just a few weeks later on May 6th of 2003. The subject of this advisory that went out to all law enforcement agencies was, quote-unquote, vandalism to auto dealerships. Part of the advisory that was released in response to a Freedom of Information Act request has been blacked out. But the portion that wasn't reads as follows, quote, "The environmental group, the Earth Liberation Front, has been very outspoken against SUVs, especially the larger ones, i.e. Cadillac Escalade and Toyota Land Cruisers. A statement issued by the Earth Liberation Front on November 28, 2002, claims that SUV use in North America has led to a dramatic rise in dependence on oil over the past 15 years. North American reliance on oil is one of the major reasons for the continuing conflict in the Middle East. Less than 2 months later, the Earth Liberation Front claimed responsibility for damaging several vehicles in Erie, Pennsylvania, after a firebomb exploded under one of the vehicles. Estimated damages were as high as $90,000. Earth Liberation Front also stated, quote, "The ELF will continue to fight to remove the profit motive from the killing of the natural environment. We urge our brothers and sisters, let us strive to become the revolutionary force we've always spoken of being." This law enforcement advisory was a very specific warning that arson attacks on SUV dealerships in California were going to occur by a group that they also had advised had just declared war on the establishment. But as far as we've been able to determine, the auto dealers who sell the larger SUVs, like the Hummers, were never warned. No measures were taken to increase security and or take other steps to protect against a pending arson attack by a known domestic terrorist group that had just declared war on the system. 3.5 months later, the attacks began on August the 22nd at 2:50 a.m., three SUVs parked on a residential street in the city of Monrovia were firebombed. The words polluter, ELF, and a circle with a letter A in the center were spray-painted on the vehicles. Within 10 minutes of that arson attack, the Monrovia Police Department gave a radio broadcast to the police department in the adjacent city of Arcadia that an SUV arson attack had just occurred, linked to the Earth Liberation Front. The Arcadia Police checked on an SUV dealership in their city, Rusnak Mercedes, and discovered that eight SUVs had been vandalized. The words ELF were left on the vehicles. 30 minutes later, another 51 SUVs were vandalized by red and blue spray paint in the city of Duarte. The words ELF were again left on the vehicles. But the largest in the series of attacks that took place on August the 22nd occurred last in the city of West Covina, which is just a few minutes south of where the first three attacks occurred. It was here that the damage was the most extensive. 72 SUVs, including 39 Hummers, were damaged by a combination of arson and vandalism. The attackers painted ELF and left messages accusing SUVs of ruining the environment. By dawn, the police and the FBI were surveying damage that stretched across four Southern California cities. There was $3.5 million in property damage. Security cameras at the Duarte SUV dealership captured images of the three perpetrators on videotape. The FBI assembled a joint task force of dozens of agents and local police officers. The district attorney of Los Angeles County labeled the arson attack as domestic terrorism and as a hate crime, and established a reward fund. Within 24 hours, the FBI focused its attention on the environmental co-op where Josh Canole lives in the city of Pomona. On September the 11th, Josh and a friend left the co-op to go to a video store to rent a movie. Josh noticed that he was being followed by five cars. What did he do? He did what any law-abiding citizen would do. He did what you and I would do if you were being followed by someone. He picked up his cell phone and he called the police. He dialed 911. He was put on hold. He made a U-turn. All five cars behind him started doing three-point turns trying to follow him. There's a tape recording of the 911 call. A dispatcher in the California Highway Patrol's Los Angeles office answered, 911 emergency, can I help you? Josh said, yeah, I'm being followed around right now. What do I do? The dispatcher directed Josh to drive immediately to his local police department, the Pomona Police Department. Police records show that Josh pulled into the lot at 11:36 p.m. on September the 11th. Five cars followed him into the parking lot. The police talked to Josh, and then they spoke with the people in the five cars. And Josh learned for the first time that it was agents of the federal government that were following him. He asked the police, "What do I do?" They said, "Well, sir, if you feel like you're being threatened, call us." He said, "Well, I just did that." So he gets in his car and he drives home, and these five cars follow him. He gets out of his car. "What do you people want from me?" And a few minutes later, one of the people, one of the cars, gets out, walks up to Josh Knoll, points a semi-automatic pistol at his head, and says, "Josh Knoll, FBI, you're under arrest." They put him on the ground and they handcuff him. And he's taken to the local FBI office. This environmental co-op, this place of harmony with the universe, this place where people have reached a point of spiritual wellness, of connection with everything that is great about being alive on this planet, is bombarded by an army of law enforcement officers who surround the house, and they embargo the house for more than 20 hours until late in the evening of the following day, when they enter with search warrants. And after 8 hours of going through that house, they leave with two SUVs filled with the personal belongings of all the residents. While all this is going on, Josh is being repeatedly interrogated, subjected to sleep deprivation, and denied food that matched his vegan diet. After 14 hours, Josh was finally arrested, booked with bail set at more than $800,000. His booking photo is leaked to the press, and Josh is smeared in local and national newspaper and television accounts. The FBI had their man. The dangerous eco-terrorist and the $3.5 million Hummer fires has been captured. While he's in jail, Josh is served with a grand jury subpoena for the clothing that he was wearing at the time of his arrest. Hair and saliva samples were taken from him. But there was absolutely no evidence with which to charge this young man with a crime. And after 4 days, he was released, and he walked out of that jail wearing a paper jumpsuit and paper slippers. An hour before Josh was released, the Los Angeles Times newspaper receives an email message that the police have the wrong man. The email message identified a math formula that had been painted on one of the cars, a fact that was known only to the police at the time. An examination of the routing codes of that email showed that it had been sent from computers here in Pasadena at Caltech and at Pasadena City College. On September the 19th, the same day that the Earth Liberation Front claimed responsibility for burning six homes under construction in San Diego, and 6 weeks after the Earth Liberation Front had taken credit for an arson fire that had destroyed an apartment complex under construction in San Diego, causing $50 million in damage, the FBI raided Caltech and Pasadena City College to search the computers. There's media coverage of the FBI campus raids, and the police persist in smearing Josh as the suspect in the SUV arson and vandalism attacks of August the 22nd. They continue to label Josh as the suspect. The FBI steadfastly refused to exonerate him. They've arrested somebody else for the crimes. They've charged somebody else with the crime. They've identified two people that have left the country. And still, they persist in smearing Joshua Thomas Knoll as a suspect in these crimes. We finally, after 5 months, were successful just a few days ago in getting the affidavit to the search warrant that justified the police entry into Josh's home. And by the way, when they went into that house, they struck gold. If the FBI wanted to know what the activist community was up to, that house in Pomona gave them a window into virtually every activist group. They seized personal records, phone records, cell phones, computers. That's the first thing they go after, is the computers. They want the computer hard drives. They copy computer hard drives and they do a forensic computer analysis of everything that's on your computer hard drive. Every place you visited on the web, every email message that you ever sent and received, they had all of it. They got all of it. They've returned all of the property now. Every single piece of property that was seized in that house has been returned. And amongst the items that they seized was this photograph. And just to show you, I had that photograph blown up. But here's the original in this FBI evidence bag. Okay? Now, what in the world is the FBI doing seizing a photograph of an anti-war activist holding up a sign saying George Bush is a fascist Nazi corporate pig? What connection could that possibly have to a crime? It makes the point that Josh has made and that I've made as his attorney from day one, that the whole point of the arrest of Josh Knoll was to smear the anti-war movement and the environmental movement. Is the FBI capable of doing that? I'm going to talk about that in just a minute. But I want to share with you some of the things that are in this affidavit because it's really unbelievable. The arson attacks occurred on August the 22nd. According to this affidavit, the FBI says that an anonymous caller known as Cooperating Witness, CW, calls the FBI and says there's suspicious activity occurring at the environmental co-op, gives the address. This is what it says in the affidavit. Several 20-year-olds live at the house, but none appear to work. Several of their vehicles have pro-environment stickers. The CW, the confidential witness, says she saw some people getting in and out of a vehicle on August the 21st at about 11 a.m., and they didn't look like there were cars that were normally associated with the location, and one of the vehicles had out-of-state license plates. The FBI claims that they ran a computer check on the address, and they came up with some information about the owner of the house, who happens to be Josh's employer, a young man who owns a solar energy panel installing company. Josh works for the company. They do a computer check of that person, and they find out that he had posted something on the web complaining that General Motors was withdrawing their electrical vehicle program, and that became a suspicious fact in this affidavit. But it goes on. They talk more and more about this anonymous cooperating witness who looks at the surveillance videotapes and says that, well, you know, the people in this videotape, they generally look like some of the people that live at the house. Within 24 hours of this arson attack, the FBI assigned the Special Operations Group, Los Angeles, FBI, Special Operations Group, SOG, S-O-G. Now, I don't know how many of you out there served in the military. I did. I know what SOG stands for. I know it was a group during the war in Southeast Asia. They wore black clothes and black hats, and they flew around in black airplanes, and they did all this covert stuff. The Special Operations Group, ladies and gentlemen, is the action squad of the FBI for the Patriot Act. And when you analyze the Patriot Act, don't just look at the Patriot Act terms itself. Look at the regulations that control and govern what the FBI can do and not do. And look what Ashcroft did in removing all of those restraints, the covert entries that they can do now, the things that they can do when they follow people. According to this affidavit, Josh Knoll was followed every day, 24 hours a day. He was under constant FBI surveillance up to and including the night of September the 11th. Now, when this affidavit was written, it was presented to a judge to justify getting a search warrant to go into Josh Knoll's home. Under the Fourth Amendment, as you all know, police can't go into your house unless a neutral and detached magistrate makes a finding of probable cause that there is information to justify what the FBI is doing. They go on at lengths to describe what happened when they were following Josh around on the night of September the 11th. And they describe what he did as counter-surveillance techniques. But they don't mention in the affidavit that Josh called 911. They don't mention that he went to the Pomona Police Department, that he talked to the police, and that the FBI had to talk to the police. They don't mention the fact that when Josh was arrested and they told him why he was arrested, he was relieved. He thought that he was arrested because of the sign that the Secret Service was mad at him. When they told him why, he was happy to talk to them. He waived his right to remain silent, and he spoke freely with the FBI. But none of that is mentioned in this affidavit. So when the judge was presented with this, the FBI deliberately and intentionally withheld information that would have been important for a judge to know in determining whether or not the FBI ought to be able to go into his home and search and seize his property. But the most amazing thing of all in this affidavit is the fact that the FBI used a bloodhound. The FBI uses bloodhounds in ways that, you know, we've all seen the movies. You know, the bloodhound is going through the swamps and searching for the escaped convict. You know, Paul Muni, I Was a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, and the black and white movies, my wife always complains that I watch old black and white movies. I never watch the new color soap operas, but I like to watch old black and white movies. But we know how bloodhounds were used traditionally to find a lost child, to locate an escaped convict. But the FBI has gone to lengths now to such an extent that the experts, the people that are experts in the law enforcement community, there's actually bloodhound law enforcement associations. They have presidents. They have boards of directors. And they're criticizing what the FBI is doing because they're taking a device that's like a small vacuum cleaner, and they're scooping up a scent off of a piece of evidence, depositing it onto a gauze pad, and then having a dog smell that gauze pad and then see if the dog will alert on one of many possible suspects. They used a dog named Knight from Southern California in Maryland in the anthrax investigation that led to the arrest and the false accusation of a doctor named Stephen Hatfield. And it was precisely the same dog named Knight that they brought out, had sniff a gauze pad, and then follow Josh when he walked from his house to the local supermarket and then walked home. And in the affidavit, it describes how this dog, you know, followed Josh's trail from the house to the supermarket and back. And the dog, they had to hold the dog back because it wanted to go up to the door of Josh's house. When I got Josh's property returned, I went to the FBI office in West Covina. And I go in, and there's an FBI agent, and he's wearing his sidearm. He's got his, you know, weapon on his belt, and I have to sign for his property. And the agent says, you know, counsel, here's your client's things. And he says, you know, we have this bag, and it's your client's shoes. He says, but I'm going to leave this bag outside in the hallway because it really smells bad, and everybody that works here has been complaining about the smell of this pair of shoes. So I'm going to leave it out here. So I have to go through the inventory, and I have to sign off for everything. And I said, thank you very much, you know, special agent, whose name, by the way, is Snock. I'm not making this up. Special Agent Snock. Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. Walking down this long hallway to the elevator, all of a sudden the door flies open, and this agent comes running out. Counsel, counsel, he's holding the bag. Please, don't leave these shoes here. Take them with you. Josh, you know, he knows I'm going to kid him about this, and he's a good-natured guy. Josh has notoriously smelly feet.
Oh my God.
He does what my oldest son does. He wears these Vans tennis shoes with white socks. And that bloodhound alerted on the fact that Josh has feet that smell, not that he was in any way connected to these arson crimes that had occurred. And by the way, I should also comment for the record, just in case Josh forgets to mention it, Josh Canol has condemned this organization known as the Earth Liberation Front and their tactics. And he has a much better way of saying it than I do. But in so many words, he says, you know, the burning of those Hummers causes more pollution than the Hummers could ever cause during a lifetime of operation on the road. He has nothing to do with this group. He's denounced them as an organization. And yet, until this day, until this very moment, the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the U.S. Justice Department, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles, continues to smear an anti-war activist as a dangerous terrorist. Now, can the FBI do it? Well, they've done it before, and I want to tell you how they did it. In 2002, a jury in Oakland, California, made an award of $4.4 million in damages, most of it for the violation of the First Amendment rights of two environmental activists, Daryl Cherney and Judy Berry, 11 years before. A pipe bomb exploded under the driver's seat of Judy Berry's car, nearly killing her and injuring her passenger, Daryl Cherney. FBI agents arrived at the scene shortly after the explosion, and they immediately told the police that Judy and Daryl were known members of a violent terrorist group, the type of people who would be involved in making and placing bombs. Despite the fact that the evidence clearly showed that they were the victims of the bombings, the FBI trumped up the preposterous charge that they had knowingly transported the bomb. They were arrested while they were still in the hospital, and the slander was quickly broadcast across the country. Dangerous eco-terrorists had been caught. A week after the bombing, an anti-abortion religious fanatic calling himself the Lord's Avenger sent a letter to a local newspaper taking credit for the bombing. He recited details about the bombing that only the bombers could know. An FBI bomb expert concluded that the bomb had been placed under the driver's seat and was detonated by a motion trigger device. But this information was kept secret, and the FBI kept smearing these two environmental activists, Judy and Daryl, as the only suspects. Finally, after 2 months, the district attorney announced that no charges would be filed because there wasn't enough evidence to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. In fact, just like in the case of Josh Knoll, there was no evidence at all. But the FBI kept pursuing a sham investigation, surveilling and harassing a wider group of environmental activists throughout California. In the meantime, the real bombers, who were never seriously sought by the FBI, are still at large. A year later, Judy and Daryl brought their lawsuit charging unlawful interference with their rights of free expression and association under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and false arrest and illegal search and seizure under the Fourth Amendment. The jury sustained these claims and awarded an unprecedented multi-million-dollar jury award against FBI agents. Now, when Judy and Daryl were arrested 12 years earlier, it was front-page news in the New York Times. But the jury verdict was buried on page 13. The verdict has received no mention in media accounts or assessments of recent FBI practices in connection with the failures and lapses leading up to the September 11th attacks. And I would commend this chapter of the ACLU to become more informed about the case of Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney. It's a very important landmark in American jurisprudence because an American jury found that environmental activists had been subjected to an FBI frame-up. I talked about COINTELPRO. Many of you here in this audience remember COINTELPRO, and you remember what that secret political intelligence program did in covertly spying on people who were engaged in law-abiding First Amendment activities. And you remember J. Edgar Hoover. You remember what he did. You remember the example of what COINTELPRO did to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King? It was the FBI who determined to neutralize him as an effective civil rights leader. It was the FBI that went to the extreme of mailing Dr. King a composite audio tape of recordings picked up by microphones that it planted in hotel rooms he'd occupied. And it was the FBI that accompanied that tape with a note suggesting that Dr. King commit suicide or face the public release of the tape. While I was in public office, while I was mayor, I became involved with one of the most notorious of all COINTELPRO cases quite by chance. My family and I were off to the beach for a weekend, and we'd stopped at a local bookstore to pick up some reading material. I happened across a book written by a former FBI agent named Wesley Swearingen. He described his work in the COINTELPRO era in Los Angeles and about the case of Geronimo Pratt, who had been convicted of a murder and was in prison for life. It seems that the FBI knew he didn't commit the murder because they had him on a surveillance audio tape in another city, in Oakland, at the time of the murder. But the FBI concealed this information from the defense and allowed Geronimo Pratt to be convicted. At the time I read this book, efforts were underway to get Geronimo a new trial, and a request for a review of the case was pending with then-District Attorney Gil Garcetti. I knew the DA personally. As mayor of Pasadena, I was working with his office in a novel approach, which some of you in the ACLU will remember, to address the problems of gang-related violence in this city through the use of civil injunctions. I wrote to the DA and asked him to take a closer look at the case, and then I began to take a closer look. I met with Geronimo's family, and I learned more about this young man who had grown up in Louisiana, was the quarterback of his high school football team, who volunteered for service in the U.S. Army, who volunteered to be a paratrooper, who was sent to the Dominican Republic and then to Vietnam, where he served two tours. And an incident that had occurred there that told a lot about this young man's character. You know, we talk about a presidential candidate named John Kerry being a hero. He received the Silver Star. Geronimo Pratt received a military decoration that's even higher than that. It's called the Soldier's Medal. He received that medal because a helicopter filled with wounded soldiers crash-landed in front of a position where he was with his fellow paratroopers, and he went out there and single-handedly rescued every one of these wounded soldiers off of a burning helicopter. This was the young man that the FBI framed and allowed to spend 27 years in prison for a crime he did not commit, the first 9 years in solitary confinement. I went to court. I offered him a job to come to Pasadena and work as a gang counselor with young people in Northwest Pasadena. I was there in court, the bail hearings. I was there at the jail in Santa Ana in Orange County when he was finally released, and we had a reception for him here at the Rose Bowl the day he got out. I want you to remember the names, Judy Berry, Daryl Cherney, Geronimo Pratt, and Josh Canole, and remember those names well when you have the discussions, the abstract discussions, about whether or not there is the potential for abuse of our civil rights and civil liberties by our government. Because it does happen, it has happened, and only groups like this, only groups like the American Civil Liberties Union, can stand between the citizens and a government which at times needs to be put under control. I'd like to respond to your questions, but before I do, I want to introduce somebody, and I want to just say that as the mayor of Pasadena, I had the opportunity to do a lot of really great things. I mean, the Dalai Lama came to Pasadena, and I had a reception for him, and I welcomed him. I mean, a lot of important people came to Pasadena, and I got to do really great things. But working on this case with Josh Canole and meeting these young people that Josh is a part of has been very rewarding and fulfilling for me, because I know that our country has a very bright future. It's in the hands of young people like Joshua Thomas Canole, and I'd like you to meet him. Josh, would you please come up?
Now, that was really nice, Phil.
It's okay. I'm 5'10", almost 5'11", I'm 5'11", almost 6 feet tall, and I look pretty short standing next to Josh. So you can see, when they were looking at those surveillance photos, and that was all this was about. It was a case of mistaken identity. He's not the guy. He has nothing to do with it. But let him tell you his story in his own words. I've said enough.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Thanks a lot. Like, Bill is really awesome, everyone. He's helped me so much. I don't know. I mean, Bill talks so articulately. It's a weird scene to describe what happened to me. I protest war every week out in Brea. We started this vigil that went from like noon until 6 on Saturdays and Sunday. So we were out in the busiest corner in Brea all weekend, every weekend for, I don't know, 10, 11 months or something. All of a sudden I just, you know, we hadn't, the protests hadn't even been going on for the last month or so, and I'd been living in this co-op for about 3 months, which is really great. It gives me an opportunity to learn how to garden more and, you know, get a better connection going on with the earth. We have solar panels, and I've ended up working for the solar panel installation company. It's a really awesome opportunity, I think. And I don't know, all of a sudden I just started being followed around one day. It's so weird, like black Mustang with tinted windows, you know? It's like out of a not story tale. We have this little electric vehicle. It's called a gem cart. And it goes 25 miles an hour. We do all our in-town commuting with it because, you know, we have solar panels, so it doesn't really cost us any gas or natural resources. And anyway, this little thing only goes 25 miles an hour, and I'm driving down the road to go to the market, and on the way back, I notice I'm being followed because it's a Mustang, and it's going slower than me behind me, and you know, people are usually like, excuse me, you're going slow, and he So it was really strange. So, you know, I make a left and a right, and the Mustang just kept going, and then it ended up behind me again. I'm like, what the heck? And so at this point, I just thought it was strange. And so I'm in this little gem cart, and I run this yellow light, and I pull into the alleyway, and I throw down the garage. I'm like, ah, ha, ha, I dish that Mustang. And I walk over to the other house, and there it is parked in front of the house. It's like, what the heck's going on? And so I tell my roommate, I'm like, yeah, there's this Mustang was following me in the gem. He's like, oh, you're crazy. It's right out. Oh, it's gone. I'm insane, you know. So I'm thinking I was totally paranoid. I didn't, you know, and I don't really drive very often, so I didn't really get in my car for a couple of days. And then when I did, I was being followed. And it was with my friend Katie, and they're following me, and I'm on my way to my dad's house. What the heck's going on? This time it was a Ford Taurus, black tinted windows. Yeah, so I mean, I pulled off the side of the road, and this person passed me, and I get behind him, and I get the license plate, and I let her go, and then she's behind me again, 2 miles down the road, and I'm like, what the heck? And so I ditch her, and I go to my dad's house, and hours later I leave, and they're waiting for me on the freeway off ramp, and it's like, what the heck is going on? I was really confused at that point. I didn't really know. I don't know. I was discussing with people in the community, like, this sign here is what I thought, you know, attracted the attention. I was like, well, I was at this Bush protest, you know, and there was cameras, and I had a big sign saying Bush is a Nazi fascist corporate pig, and maybe the Secret Service is unhappy. That was the best theory we all had going on. So, yeah, I mean, it went on every day. I mean, it got to the point for a couple days before I was arrested, like, there's 15 members in the community, and we were like, well, so who hasn't been followed? Oh, you want to hop in the car? And it was really strange. I mean, really, really strange. The one thing I wanted, you know, when I called 911, the whole counter tactics thing, I'd been being followed for almost 2 weeks at that point, and all I did was take a photograph of the person following me. I was like, I'm 1 minute out of the car, and then, you know, they're behind me again. I was like, oh, great. He's like, I have a camera. Cool. And then, you know, then there were 5 vehicles, and they were unhappy, and I was following me in a circle as I'm on hold with 911. And when I got to the police station, they held me like this, and they searched me and Katie, and they sat us on the curb while the FBI, I mean, it was like I called 911 here, and I was being treated like I was a criminal, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. It was really strange. In fact, I had called people from the house, and they drove down the road, and they were sitting on the sidewalk because the police wouldn't let me closer because I had no idea what was going on. We were quite frightened. Like, I didn't know what was happening. And so then the police officer approaches me, and I'm like, okay, so who are they? Why are they following me? And he's like, well, all I can say is that they're agents of the government. What? You know? Yeah, I was like, well, what department, they're agents of the government. And, well, what should I do? Well, if you feel threatened, you should call 911. Wait a minute, man. So I drove home, and I was followed home, and I don't know. Then I was shortly arrested after that. Another thing Bill really missed over was, you know, a lot of the support for me while I was in jail was amazing. I have a anti-war movement community, and the environmental co-op I live in the community based around that, who all know me very well and know that I would, well, in fact, they were rallying before anyone, they were already raiding our house before they had told anyone why I was even arrested. No one even knew what it was about to begin with. But they all rallied around support, you know, and we had the news media that night. As they're raiding the house, the news media was there, and there was a rally of like 50 people there and or something like that. And that really helped me. I mean, I had a phone in the cell, and I'm on the phone, and wow, we're having this rally here. I mean, that helped me on an emotional level, and it also helped on a it didn't let it get swept under the rug. I mean, it was on TV that at least, yes, he's an eco-terrorist, but also, look, his friends say he's not. at least it was something. And, you know, like, as far as advice, I would say I went in there and I talked to those FBI agents, and that was a bad idea. They hauled me in there. I'd been being followed for weeks. I had no idea what was going on. And he's like, well, here, sign this piece of paper that waives your right to an attorney and this. And I'm like, no, I'm not signing my rights away or anything. And, okay, well, then just listen to me. I'm sure you want to know what this is about, and so you can just listen. I'm like, okay. So he's like, oh, well, you burned all these Hummers in West Covina, and we're going to bust you. And I'm like, no. I really, once I knew it was about that, once he said that, I was like, oh, great. I didn't do that, so I'll just tell these nice FBI agents and I'll be on my way. That's just bad advice. Don't talk to... I mean, I really wish I had known to... I knew. I mean, Katie yelled at me as they were running away. Don't talk to them. There's no reason, you know? But I don't know. I was naive at that point. I felt that, you know, I don't burn Hummers. I'll tell them I don't burn Hummers. Be on my way. But, I mean, it got to the point of ridiculousness. They're like, the pants you're wearing right now are the same pants you had on 3 weeks ago when you burned these Hummers, and there's paint speckles on them, and our lab is going to analyze them as they're stealing my pants from me. And then he asked me if I've seen the Crime Scene Investigators TV show. And I'm like, well, no, I don't watch TV. Oh, well, we have hard science. And, you know, and wow. And they tell me the bloodhound sniffed your lighter. And how'd your lighter get on the scene? What lighter? I have no idea what you're talking about. And we're going to catch your friend. And, you know, he's going to turn you in. You better turn him in first because you want the spray paint charge, not the arson charge, because the spray paint wiped off real easy. And I'm like, what? I mean, it made no sense to me. I kept repeating myself. I'm like, okay, well, I didn't do that. You know, I didn't burn any Hummers, and I have no idea what you're talking about. It and circles, till like the third day when he came back and was just like, wow, this is really bleeping serious. I'm going to bleep. Your whole life is going to bleep, 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 bleep. I don't know, whatever. I don't want to say the whole thing because he was full of cuss words, and that point was when I did not want to talk to him anymore. And right around exactly then is when I met Bill Paparian for the first time, and... that really helped a whole lot. I don't know. I had no idea what was going on. I really felt that they were going to frame me for this. I had nothing I could do. I'm broke. I didn't have a lawyer. I don't know what's going on. I'm going to be framed for something I didn't do. And this guy's cussing at me, telling me I'm going to go to jail for my whole life. And then they released me the next day, like out of nowhere. They told Bill and they told all of my friends who had a rally outside the courthouse ready, they told them that I was being transferred to L.A. They even told me that morning that I was being transferred to L.A. and this and that. And instead, he starts walking me down the hall, and I'm like, well, I need to make a phone call. And he's like, no, no, put your stuff over here. I'm like, okay, and like the blanket they gave me. And he opens the door, and I walk out, and he closes it. And I'm like, he's like, well, I'm all right. He's like, you're being released. I'm like, are you kidding? He's like, no. And I'm like, okay. And I walk out the door, and it was like an empty structure. Like, and there I was in a paper suit, free, I guess. It was really strange. It was just like, hello, I'm free now. It was like really weird. You know, yeah. So, anyway, I had a whole rally of friends out there outside the courthouse, like probably 50 of them or so, and we had some TV media come out, and that was all good. And Bill came after he was running around the LA courthouse looking for me all day, and actually, a police officer came earlier, just before I was released, and tried to tell my friends that I had been transferred to L.A. too. And he came back and apologized and said that he had been told to say that, and he had no idea that I was actually being held there. So it was very obvious that they did not like the fact that we were making it public. And I do think that if, you know, when things like this happen to any of us, if our rights are being violated, we need to be as outspoken with it as we can, and we need to have support communities like this and to support our people and keep them out of harm's way. And from there, William really helped me, one, and deal with the media. I had never done anything like that. What do I say out of all this? You know, I had heard of COINTELPRO before all this happened to me. I've heard of McCarthyism. I know that the government suppresses anti-war movement, blah, 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 blah. I went and I stood on the corner. I'd never, you know, I'm like, we're like, we would stand out there and we're like, wow, I wonder if we're going to get in trouble for this, you know, just like naively because, you know, but it was kind of a joke and I never took it seriously. Even once I had been arrested, I still talked to these people because I still thought it was fake. But it's real. Like, the men in black, the COINTELPRO, the FBI, I mean, all that is real. And they do want to silence people, and they want to take away our rights. And, I mean, it's a very real situation. And I think having this happen to me is what it took to make it seem that real to me. You ready for questions? Yeah. Also, I don't know what time's appropriate for it, but I do want to see if I can pass around a hat or something for some money for Bill for representing me, because I'm a very broke individual, and he's represented me pro bono from the beginning, and I'm trying to raise him some money for that now. Thanks, everyone. And this guy right here had his hand up a long time ago, so.
Chris asked me.
No, I
don't. Let me just answer. Chris asked me to just make a mention. If you're going to write out a check, and we hope that you might, that you make it payable to the neighborhood church, because there's apparently a restriction on any fundraising activity. It has to go through the church before it comes to the Josh Canole Defense Fund. And if there's any cash put in there, it'll go to the church. We'll make sure it's accounted for properly, and everything will be on the up and up. Yes, sir.
You also represent the young man. There's been inaccurate reporting in the Star News, which is not unusual. But at any rate, they've been mentioned several times. A graduate student at Caltech has been named as a co-defendant with this young man. Do you represent that man as well?
No, I do not. And he is not a co-defendant. His name is William Billy Cottrell. He has been, you see, the difference was, in that case, before they arrested him, the FBI talked to him first, and they got an arrest warrant from a judge. They went to the grand jury, and they got an indictment before they arrested him. Big difference in the way they handled his case and Josh's case. That young man is being held without bail. He's being held in a federal facility in San Bernardino. Even though there's one right here in Los Angeles, he has two local lawyers. I've met them. They're both very fine attorneys, Marvin Rudnick and Michael Mayock. They're both former U.S. attorneys. He has his own legal defense team. There is no way that I could in any way represent both people. It would be a conflict of interest for me. But that is a case that will be coming up in the courts. I would recommend that you go on the Internet and don't rely on the Star News for information about that case or any other case. Yes, sir.
Are you finding any action against the government for false arrest?
Yes, absolutely. We have the question was, are we planning any action against the government for false arrest? We've already begun the first phase of that, which is to file claims against both the city of West Covina, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the U.S. Justice Department, and the Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Many of you know that before you can bring a lawsuit for violations of Fourth Amendment rights, of First Amendment rights, which clearly has happened in the case of Josh Canole, you have to put the government on notice of the claim. Now that we have this search warrant affidavit, which we have been struggling for 6 months to get released to us, we are now in a very, very strong position. They didn't want us to have this information. They put it off as long as they could. And I think that they hoped that this case would die out, that the news media would lose interest in the case. And they haven't. The editors at the Los Angeles Times, the people at CNN, and an affiliate of the Star News called the Daily Bulletin and the San Gabriel Valley Tribune, which are linked to the same newspaper chain, especially the editors of the Daily Bulletin, have made sure that this case is not ignored. And I think that you expect to see articles in the newspapers, especially about the FBI bumbling and mishandling and the misuse of bloodhound evidence in this case. Yes, sir.
How was Josh confused with the fellow Caltech? How did that happen?
Well, the fellow Caltech is not proven guilty yet, and according to his lawyers and himself, is not guilty. So we don't know that he's necessarily the person who burned those Hummers. The question is, how was I identified with the person in the surveillance video? Because,
Well, there's the FBI version, and there's what we think really happened. The FBI version is that the confidential witness, this anonymous person who said that it was suspicious that there was people living at this house and the whole business and the surveillance the video and the comparison of the general description of the person in the surveillance video and Josh can just share with them how you went through that photo session with the FBI when you were in jail.
Well, yeah, I was in jail, and the FBI gave me the pictures. They gave me the pictures, and they gave me a magnifying glass that can focus to look at this surveillance photo and tell them, you know, oh, this wasn't me. And the guys, first of all, my goatee is like, you know, way down here. The guy's goatee was like, I couldn't even see it with a magnifying glass with focus. I'm like, are you sure he has a goatee? You know, and I was like, what? And the guy's hair was like this short here. My hair is very long. And so Stan tells me, oh, well, you could have had a bandana on or something. And he just didn't look like me. Anyone who knows me looks at it and it's just like, that's not me. I don't know.
So how do they decide to compare Josh with the person in the video? We say it's because, remember I told you about the law enforcement bulletins that the California Anti-Terrorism Information Center sent to all law enforcement agencies, including the FBI. You can find the Earth Liberation Front in the ranks of the anti-war protest movement. So what did they do? They went through their file photos. We know that they were surveilling the anti-war protesters. And they see a guy, tall, lanky, Josh Canole, 6'2" to 6'4". He resembles, generally, one of the people depicted in the surveillance photo. But ladies and gentlemen, is that enough for the U.S. government to arrest somebody, to smear them as a terrorist, and go in and raid their home? I don't think so. Maybe under John Ashcroft's Twilight Zone that happens, but it shouldn't happen in this country. We've got to put a stop to it. That's the reason why we have the Fourth Amendment, to protect us. We have to make sure this kind of thing doesn't repeat, does not happen again to anybody, because it very likely could happen to any of us.
One question is regarding the Patriot Act. Do you know if the Patriot Act, if he was arrested under the Patriot Act, you know, he even said the jury's, there was a grand jury subpoena? And also, an article I read in the Whole Life Times, I think it said one of your friends called you, Josh, and said, what'd you do, blow up an SUV factory or something like that? And
yes, which is funny because the FBI mentioned that when they're interrogating me, but it's not in the affidavit anywhere. When one of my employees at EE Solar, who he doesn't know me that, I mean, I know him like through work and that's it. Like he doesn't live at the house or anything like that. And he knows, you know, I'm an anti-war activist. I'm always talking about, oh, this weekend I was out protesting here and there and whatnot. And so I guess he heard about this Hummer incident. I didn't even hear about it. Oh, well, obviously the FBI heard this cell phone conversation. Yeah. Because in the cell phone conversation, he said to me, He jokingly was like, what, are you blowing up SUVs? And I was like, I didn't even know what he was talking about. I was like, no, what are you talking about? And I said, oh, somebody blew up an SUV. Up to the time I was arrested by the FBI, I thought literally like someone bombed one SUV or something. I had no idea. Even after I was released from jail and being interrogated by the FBI, I had no idea that it spanned four cities and lit this kind and that kind all over. I mean...
The question is, what evidence do we have that Josh Canole's case is linked to the Patriot Act? Well, the attorney who's handling the Josh Canole case, who's handling the investigation of the SUV arson fires, is an assistant U.S. attorney named Beverly Reed O'Connell. Very fine attorney. I have no complaints about her. She's conducted herself in a very professional way. When the League of Women Voters has a forum about the Patriot Act at the Pasadena Public Library, who comes from the U.S. attorney's office to defend the Patriot Act? The very same Beverly Reed O'Connell. She's assigned to the terrorism section of the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Central District of California. Item number two, Joint Terrorism Task Forces. Joint Terrorism Task Forces are the FBI's extension of the Patriot Act. Remember what I said, don't just look at the Patriot Act terms. Look at the FBI guidelines that Ashcroft, under the Patriot Act, has released the restrictions. The Special Operations Group, FBI Los Angeles, is the black bag unit of the FBI. They're the ones that they look like anybody in this room. They drive around not just in black Mustangs but tinted out windows, but with commercial vans with ladders on top. Was one of the vehicles that followed Josh in. I've seen the photographs of these people. You'd never guess that they were FBI agents. Did they make a covert entry into Josh Canole's home before September the 11th when they arrested him? We think so. And I'll tell you why. They allowed, during the 24 hours that they had that home embargoed, the residents to go back into the house. Standing outside on a sidewalk in front of the house was the father of one of the occupants. I'm not going to mention his name, but he is a 30-year veteran of the Los Angeles Police Department, a detective who has executed dozens of search warrants in his career. Bill, I couldn't understand why would they let people back into the house? When they let them back into the house, they told them to sit in one room, in the living room, in one area of the house. Why did they do that? I'm a criminal defense attorney. I'm in the courts of Los Angeles day in and day out. Law enforcement technique number one. They arrest a couple of kids for stealing a car. What do they do with the kids? They put them in the back seat of the patrol car, and the two police officers walk over to the corner and smoke a cigarette. The two kids think that they're alone in the back seat of the car. There's no Fifth Amendment privilege when two suspects are talking amongst themselves. The patrol cars are wired for sound, and they want to get incriminating statements. So what did they do? They allowed all the people that lived in the house to go back in this house while they're waiting for the search warrant to occur. Why? Because they had no evidence with which to hold Josh, and they were on a fishing expedition, and they were getting the people on audio tape. And when they went in and executed the search warrant, nobody could see them when they executed that search warrant. And we believe that during the execution of the search warrant, they simply removed the audio recording devices because they knew that people would suspect that that's what the FBI did after they went in and executed the search warrant. No, they removed them when they went in. Special Operations Group, FBI Los Angeles. It's the black bag unit of the FBI, and that's the connection with the Patriot Act. Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, there could be other connections with the Patriot Act that you don't know about because there could be searches connected under the FISA that were authorized by FISA court that have been kept secret. Is that something you think you might be able to find out about?
You know, only the limits of time and the fact that my wife was sitting in the audience, and I think she's still here, prevented me from, I'm going to introduce the former First Lady of Pasadena, my wife, Sona. Just stand up so everybody can see you. The fact that she was here was keeping me honest, so I didn't go overboard with my presentation. But I have a whole analysis of the Patriot Act and the kinds of things that they can do. Under the Patriot Act, they can monitor everything that you're doing on the Internet. Did you know that? They can keep a list of everyone you email or receive email from. The same thing can be done with your telephone calls, all without court approval. Patriot Act. They can enter your home secretly to sneak and peek. Patriot Act. That's what we think happened in the case of Josh Ganahl. Jim, to answer your question, in the lawsuit, which will take a decade before it, you know, winds its way through the courts, all of this is going to come out. We're going to find out exactly what they were up to and what they did. We suspect that this is what they did based upon the track record of what they've done in the past. Yes, sir.
Are you free now, or what is your situation?
Yeah, I haven't been. I was only in jail for the 4 days. They released me and then released statements to the press saying they expected to be seeing me again in a couple of weeks, and that I'm still a suspect. And
did you have to post bond?
No, they had no evidence. They released me. I never even saw a judge.
But when they put his bail up, there's a bail schedule in L.A. County for all the court, uniform bail schedule. They got a bail deviation to double the bail. It should have been $400,000. It was more than $800,000. They did that to keep him in jail. That's another document we hope to get. They had to fill out an affidavit to get a deviation from the bail schedule.
Do you know what judge?
Yes, it was Judge Falls in West Covina was the judge who issued the arrest warrant. Not the arrest warrant, the search warrant. There was a state search warrant. And in federal court, it was Magistrate Judge Johnson who issued the federal counterpart of the warrant. I'm sorry?
Why isn't he still in jail?
Because you can't hold somebody in jail in this country unless you're in a military brig in South Carolina because you've been designated as an enemy combatant by President Bush. They can't hold you in jail unless there's a determination made that there's probable cause to hold you in jail beyond 48 hours and a case has been filed. They took this case
to the bail due for being accused.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question. I thought you asked me why.
I thought it was ridiculous. He had
No, he didn't post bail because they released him because there was no evidence with which to charge him with a crime. If he wanted to get bailed out, if they did file a case against him, they had gotten the bail increased, double the amount that would be normally called for. I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. Yes, sir.
Is there any way that Josh might have been investigated or arrested under the Patriot Act provisions if they would have waited longer to get a judge or to grant an order under the Patriot Act for domestic terrorism or something like that?
Sure. There is a grand jury that convened in Los Angeles to investigate the crimes that happened at the Hummer arson sites. And they would have to get an arrest warrant, but they'd have to have a more thorough investigation. Look, when we went down to the U.S. Attorney's office after Josh was released. They had served him with subpoenas for his clothing that they had seized when he was arrested. And we went down there. There are times when you do talk to the government when you have a lawyer with you. Josh Canole has an ironclad alibi for his whereabouts the night these crimes occurred. And if they had accorded him the decent thing would have been to, instead of following him around and hounding him, Mr. Canole, you look like the person in this photograph. Where were you the night that these crimes occurred? And he could have, you know, declined to talk to him, or he would have hopefully contacted an attorney and gone in. We have sworn statements from five eyewitnesses that can corroborate where Josh was the night he was supposedly involved in these crimes. So to answer your question, they did not get an arrest warrant. They could not have gotten an arrest warrant. And when they got the search warrant, they didn't provide the judge with all the facts. There's more people that haven't had a chance to ask any questions. Yes, ma'am.
Maybe I missed this. Why do you think they targeted him in the first place? And my other question is, do you know what they supposedly used to give the scent to the blood?
Okay. Why did they target Josh, and what did they use to give the scent? What we understand from the information that we've received, there was a cigarette lighter found at the scene of the arson fire in West Covina. And they took the cigarette lighter, and they scooped up a scent, and they deposited it onto the gauze pad, and using the technique that I described for you earlier. And the other question was, why did they focus on Josh?
I don't think you finished the answer of the bloodhound.
Oh. I thought I did. What part did I miss?
Well, that's the false positive. That's what they did. But they did the way they did that is totally the false positive way they used bloodhounds. So that's nothing.
The bloodhound experts say when you use that technique, when you transpose a scent through a vacuum cleaning device onto a pad, and then ask a bloodhound to determine who amongst a group of people could possibly be connected with that scent, you are increasing the likelihood of a false positive of an innocent person being falsely accused of the crime. And in the case of the bloodhound that they did use, I have court documents that bloodhound is corroborated in less than 1 out of 4 instances when it has been used, which means that there was a more than 75% possibility of a false positive in the use of a bloodhound, this particular bloodhound that we used in the case of Josh Canole.
Which means it wasn't even my scent on the lighter at all. It was just a dog that's trained to wag its tail.
why did they focus on Josh in the first place? You have the FBI version, and you have what we believe happened. The FBI version is we got a call from an anonymous person who said there's suspicious activity. I don't know what was suspicious about what she reported, allegedly, occurring at that house. The FBI, within 24 hours, assigns a complete unit to conduct 24-hour surveillance of one person at that house. And they believe that there may be a resemblance between the person in the surveillance photograph and Josh Canole. They take a surreptitious photograph of Josh coming in and out of his house. We don't think that's how it happened. We think that the FBI had been warned to look at the anti-war protest movement. They had specific advisories. The Earth Liberation Front, domestic terrorists will be found at anti-war protests. They have a person in a surveillance photograph video who's very tall and lanky. Josh Knoll stands out in a crowd. They went through their file photos of surveillance photos, and this particular anti-war protest had attracted a lot of attention. There was a lot of FBI attention on that, the Brea group, and that's why they targeted Josh. That's why they focused on Josh.
Yeah, and I started that protest.
In your hometown, right?
In my hometown, yeah. So I'm sure I was on the top of the pile. Yeah.
I think what I'd like to say as the host for the evening is that if you're willing to stay and talk with people afterwards,
I'm going to hang around, and I'd like to talk with anyone who wants to talk with me. And,
sure, we'll hang on.
I have community meals at my co-op as well. If anyone's interested in coming and checking that out, just let me know.
Thank you all both very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to attorney William Paparian, former mayor of Pasadena, California, and his client Josh Knoll, an environmental, social justice, and anti-war activist targeted by the FBI, who accused him of bombing Hummer dealerships in Southern California. They spoke at the neighborhood church in Pasadena on May 4, 2004. On May 28, the city of West Covina issued Josh a formal apology, as well as a monetary award. Yet, the FBI smear of Josh as a suspect continues unabated. Josh can be reached at www.regen.org or 909-469-5100. Bill Paparian can be reached at bpaparian@aol.com or area 626-795-1750. Donations to the Josh Knoll Legal Defense Fund can be sent to 6815 HOMAN Court, Chino, California 91710. This program was videotaped by Chris Den Productions in Los Angeles. The audio was produced by the LA Sound Posse, a collective that records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We distribute them via community radio and the internet, and as CDs distributed through independent bookstores and other grassroots means. Our goal is to be part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. If you valued what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized, democratic civic media. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD, or you can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net.